Right, we are in Romans chapter 12, and of course, this follows the great doctrinal section of the book of Romans in chapters 1 through 11. And take a look at Romans 12, 1. Paul says, I beseech you, therefore. You see that, therefore? What is that therefore, do you think, you see? Yeah, in view of what he already said, and in view of the doctrine that he's given to us in the first 11 chapters, now he's going to beseech us as to how we ought to act as a Christian. You know, a lot of people like the science of the doctrine, you know. Some people are doctrinally oriented. I'm kind of that way. But really, doctrine is designed that we might lead a proper Christian life, isn't it? That's really what it's all about. If we don't have that as our goal, it's just an intellectual exercise. And so, because of all the doctrine that he's taught in the first 11 chapters, he then says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. What does that mean, do you think? By the mercies of God. What is that? What's Paul getting at there? What's that?
If it's God's will.
Well,
the mercies.
he wants us to base our Christian conduct upon the mercies of God. And I've come to understand that if we really expect people to change their behavior, they do so because they love Christ. They do so because they are appreciative of what God has done by his sheer grace for me, you see. I mean, you can put a bunch of rules down in front of people. They may or may not obey the rules, but they're really not obeying them in their heart, are they? But if you get somebody to love you, then they're more inclined to do that which you would ask them to do. That the same principle works with employers and employees, masters and servants. Of course, God is the great master. We're servants of the great master, and he has chosen to encourage us to live for him by getting us to love him. God fully understands that concept, you know. It wasn't the concept that we came up with. It's the one he came up with. And he said, here, I will do everything for you freely. We love that song, don't we, Brother Dan? Freely, freely. And God does everything freely for us. He does it on the front end for us. Did you ever notice that? God does it on the front end. And then he says, obey me. Then he says, live for me this way. Almost all other religions do it just backwards. They say, do this, then God will love you. You see? Act in a certain way, then God will love you. That's not the way it works. God comes down and loves us first. And he loves us completely, and he loves us graciously, asking nothing in return on the front end. That's our understanding of grace. Salvation is clearly of God. It originates in his heart. God does it from beginning to end. He does it all for us graciously when we don't deserve it. And then he says in Romans 12, 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. So because God has done all this for you, hung with his arms stretched out on a cross, bleeding and dying, suffering, if God has done all that for you, then here's what you should do. Now, Some religions do have stringent requirements. I'm not an expert on other religions by any means, but my understanding is that the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the 144,000 seats are already filled up there in heaven. And if you want a seat there, now you have to work for it. And you have to go out and knock on so many doors. I don't know if any of you are experts on Jehovah's Witness, but you go out and you knock on so many doors, and you eventually earn your way in.
Yes. Are that the same as the Latter-day Saints?
That's the Mormons, Latter-day Saints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a couple in Plantation.
Yeah. But most all religion, in fact, I would say almost without exception, every religion besides Christianity is a works religion. Did you ever notice that? You have to do this in order to get there. And that shows you what's in the heart of man, you see. We want to get there on our own merits, don't we? We want to puff out our chest and say, look how good I am, God. Don't I deserve to be here? Yes.
Just like with our family. We love them and we want to do something. We don't stand around and wait.
There is a completely different mindset in the Christian who has been saved by grace. And it is a mindset not of earning his favor, but it's a mindset of loving him in return. That's what it is. And so Paul is getting at that when he says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. Just think about the mercies of God for a while, you see. Think of what he's done for you. Now, God has forgiven me more sins than he forgave you. That's why I love him more, you see. You know, I'm joking there, but we're all great sinners. Before him.
Brother Ron, you know, people, this is what I think. We're saved from the penalty of sin, the sin of Adam. And people say, don't you want to be forgiven of your sins, of all the bad things you've done? Now, is Christ going to forgive us of Adam's sin or that? Which one of those don't save us?
Well, he obviously does both. When I draw that ledger sheet, the question that Miss Bernice had is, does God just forgive us of the penalty of sin? Does he forgive us of, you know, our actual sins? You know, is it Adam's sin that he forgives? And then we're left with our own. That wouldn't do us much good, would it? You know. So when we talk about this ledger sheet, when God forgives us, he forgives us, first of all, of Adam's sin, of course. We had Adam's sin on our ledger sheet, didn't we?
That's why we had all the other sins.
Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so death passed upon all men. It's called imputation. Adam was our representative, and when Adam sinned, his sin and guilt was written down on our ledger sheets. You see, the chance was all over. The chance was in the garden. Adam was created in innocence. He had the opportunity to go one way or the other. He chose the way of sin. We don't have that choice. We're born sinners, aren't we? We're born that way. In fact, David says he was conceived that way, you see. And that's the reality of the matter. Many people don't see that. Many people don't believe that or will not accept it, you see. But some people might say, as you suggested, Miss Bernice, that, well, maybe God forgave forgave Adam's sin, but what happens when we sin, you see? Our sin is a direct result of Adam's sin. It's because of who we are. We are sinners. We're conceived that way. We're as guilty as Adam is. Not only did we have his name written down on our ledger sheet, but his guilt and his penalty as well, hanging over us. But God writes all of that off. He forgives all of that. That's what Jesus did. Jesus came to undo the curse. And therefore, if we are ever going to serve Christ, it's going to be because we have a keen sense of what he's done for us. If you don't have that, I'm not sure that you really even know what salvation is, you see. It's foundational to salvation is we understand how desperate we were and how hopeless. And God comes along and rewrites our ledger sheet, just to complete the thought. He forgives all of this, and then he writes something on our positive side. What is that? Righteousness, right? Righteousness. He imputes righteousness to our account. So Paul says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. But I started to say that most religions have all of these requirements that you must do in order to be saved. God saves us first, then he tells us what he'd like for us to do. Do you think Christianity has stringent requirements? That's kind of a tricky question. Because Jesus, in some sense, says, the burden is light, right?
Yeah.
Take upon you my yoke. My yoke is easy. Burden is light. Yes, he's a loving God even after he saves us. I found that he gives us things that he didn't even have in this life. A house, a home, a family. Food to eat, and food in our cupboard. Many times he had to go down and find a coin in a fish's mouth, didn't he? He gives us what he didn't even have. I'm not complaining about the Christian life. It's a wonderful life, right?
It's a wonderful life. You know, it's the love of Jesus in our hearts that drives us. I see Ruth back here. She is a perfect example of someone that really loves God. She comes by herself.
Yep.
Since Brother Camp died, it's amazing. I mean, a lot of women, even I, when I lost Brady, I didn't want to get out at night.
Yeah.
Ruth comes for God.
Yeah. There's something that God works in us, yeah, in our heart. It's... Yep, John is here every time the doors are open. Dan and each one of us are here. I have to be. So I don't count, but at any rate, we do it because we love him. But on the other hand, the Christian life requires us to give everything. Everything. In that sense, it's more stringent than any other religion. We don't have to.
Our whole life is around Jesus Christ.
Yes.
He's the center. Everything we do.
He is. Some religions say, look, here's what you have to do. You have to go out and you have to spend 5 hours a week doing so and so. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what they do at the other time, you see. That's yours. You have to come on certain day of the week and drop your money in the box, go through a ritual, and that's what it is to be saved. But you know what God requires of us? I present you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. Now, that word right there, some people like to take that in the most literal sense is, well, that's all God wants is just the outward performance, you see. He wants your body. Just jump through the hoops and do your little thing from week to week. That's all God wants. No, when He says, I want your bodies, He means your whole self. That's what it really means. I want your whole self. That's a hard thing, isn't it? Because we live in this world. We have lots of needs. We have to work. We have families to take care of. We have many things to do in this world. We saw, was it 2 weeks ago, was it, in Matthew, that a man said, I'll follow you wherever you go, but let me go bury my father first. You see? And that's the extent of most of many people's religion, you see. I'll follow you next week. I'll follow you. But let me take care of my business this week.
People say, I'll go to church next Sunday, but this is just once in a week, or once in a lifetime.
Yeah. The weather's nice, and we really need to get out as a family and have a picnic. And it'll be raining next week, and we'll come. And you see what happens when it rains, right? But at any rate, it's interesting that the Lord does require something of us. He requires that we present our bodies. We present our bodies as a sacrifice. Do you see that? We're sacrificing our own self for Him. That's about as stringent a requirement that you can imagine. And Paul says, I beseech you by the mercies of God that you present your bodies. It's a living sacrifice, by the way. It's a sacrifice that we make while we're walking this earth, isn't it? He normally doesn't require us to die on a cross. Jesus did. Jesus paid that penalty for us. And sometimes God does ask us to sacrifice our life in a physical way. There have been many martyrs, and there, you know, maybe even today there are more Christian people being slaughtered than ever before. We happen to live in a country that, at least for the time being, has religious freedom. Nobody is coming into our sanctuary and gunning us down because we're Christians yet. But in many countries, that's not the case. If you were to worship openly as a Christian, you put your life at risk, you see. But Paul is talking about a living sacrifice here. That means that you are walking around sacrificing your self every day. Every moment of every day, right? A living sacrifice. My experience is that it hasn't been an unpleasant sacrifice. It's been very pleasant to serve God for all these years. But Paul says that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. It's holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Some people translate that your spiritual worship. Did you know that's really what worship is? Worship is obedience to God. That's basically what it is. Whether you're sitting here in this pew, or whether you're sitting at your kitchen table, or wherever you're sitting or standing, that's what worship of God is. Many people conceive of worship as the hour that we spend in here from 11 to 12. Maybe a prayer is uttered. We open the Bible and read a few words out of the Scriptures, and people think that's what worship is, and that is an act of worship. But that's 1 hour out of your day. What about the other 23, you see? And when we offer our bodies a living sacrifice, that's our spiritual worship. We should not think of our the time we spend in this building as the sum total of our Christian life. Some people do. And when they walk out the doors, it's forgotten. And that's not Christianity. That might be religion. Religion in the negative sense. Thinking that, okay, I'll go do this and God will accept me and then I'll walk out the doors and I'll live another way. We don't do that around here, do we? That's what I like about our church. We're small, but we believe that it's that the Christian life is lived everywhere at all times. Yes, I think that's why the Lord commanded that we assemble together on the first day of the week. He said at least that much, because we just have to have that consistent reminder. And that's what's very good about our meetings here at church. We get that consistent reminder about the Christian life. But we view our Christian life as taking place, for the most part, outside these buildings, you see. And if it's not, then it's not real to you. But if you go home and you're worshiping the Lord, then something's going on in your heart. So that's our spiritual worship. What's our duty in this life after God has saved us by His marvelous grace? Why? He says, don't be conformed to what? Don't be conformed to this world. Now that's a hard thing, because we're born conformed to this world, aren't we? We are conformed to it. We just fit right in with it, our old wicked hearts. Yeah. You know, we fit right in with this world. But Jesus said, okay, since I've done all this for you, will you now break away from that old system? Don't be conformed to it. Now, it fits us like a glove, but we better take that glove off. You see, that's our, in general, what our duty is. It's to break away from this system of thought, this system of practice, and not to be conformed to that. You can be pretty sure that whatever the world says, it's probably anti-God. Probably is. And normally, whatever you watch on the television set is going to be anti-God, isn't it? But Paul says, don't be conformed to this world. It's a hard thing, because we're asked to not be what we naturally are when we're born into this world. You know, after a child has been raised for 18 years, it's going to be hard to change him then, isn't it? And after we've lived in this world for a while, it's hard to change us. That's why it has to be by God's power, doesn't it? It has to be by His working in us. But we also have, it's our duty to avail ourselves of those means of grace so that we will be pried away from the thoughts and the practices of this world. So our duty is to not be conformed to this world, but be what? Transformed. So we need to be transformed. There's a whole transformation that has to take place in our lives. We picked up four tadpoles the other day and put them in a little fishbowl for Sebastian. And we told him, you know what? Those tadpoles are eventually going to be frogs. They don't look like frogs when we put them in there. They were just days old, I suppose, when we found them. And they certainly didn't look like frogs. But you know what? In about 3 or 4 weeks, they started sprouting little legs. And they started looking like frogs. They went through a transformation, didn't they? And there's a big transformation that has to take place in our life. It's a huge transformation. It's a transformation from what we were to the holiness of Christ. That's a big transformation. Now, ultimately, God is going to do it in a full way when He gives us new bodies without a sin nature and all that. But our duty in the meantime is to be transformed. And how is this transformation accomplished? By the renewing of your mind. Do you see that? I don't think that means purely an intellectual thing. When the mind is used in the Scriptures, it's talking about your whole makeup, your mind, your soul, your emotions, and so forth. And all of that needs to be renewed. What does that mean? Well, you know, we lost a lot of that when we fell in Adam. And Christ has come to renew our minds, make it new again. So our duty is not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. I do think it has a lot to do, though, with knowledge. The Scriptures emphasize knowledge. Have you ever noticed that? And we spend a lot of time in here emphasizing knowledge, don't we? Sometimes people say, "Preacher, can't you just leave us alone for a while? You know, we're full of, our minds are full right now." But that's one of the main duties of pastors and teachers, is to give you information and knowledge, because God uses that knowledge to renew your mind. And so don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Our will does not always match up with His will, does it? You know, Isaiah, I think it was, said, "My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways." And that nothing could be more true than that. And so we have to have our mind renewed by knowledge of the Scriptures, so that we can prove by our actions what is the will of God. The Bible is the will of God. The Bible teaches us what is the will of God, at least partially. So we know if it's in the Bible, if it's in the Scriptures, that's His will for us. And so it requires a lot of learning, doesn't it? I grew up in churches, by the way, that didn't, I just don't remember it being a lot of learning. I just don't remember it being that way. I was young, of course. I'm not down on them at all. I came through it, and the Lord worked through those things with me, but I just don't remember it being, even when I began Bible college, my knowledge was so small, you know. I didn't know anything really about the Bible. I felt the Lord's call on my life, but I didn't, when I got to Bible college, I said, "What's this? You know, what all these things they're talking about, you know?" And, but we try to give our people a good firm foundation in the Scriptures, right? From week to week.
Now,
when you learn the doctrines of the Bible, the fundamental truths of the Bible, particularly the doctrines of grace, it changes your whole perspective on life. It changes your whole church experience. It changes your relationship to others. It makes you excited to serve the Lord. You see, the doctrines of grace. That's what Paul meant when he said, I beseech you by the mercies of God.